Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Forrest Stevens Show. In today's episode, I have a guest on named Jeff Kitchen. He is a writer, he is a dramatist, and he is a consultant for anybody looking to write a script. In this podcast, he shares how he learned the skills that he has to be able to teach people the structure and everything else that goes into writing a screenplay. He also talks about the entire creative process and his personal story, as well as his, we get a little bit into this breathing technique that he learned that helps him with his writing, as well as just general life. I don't want to give too much away, so I'll let the podcast kind of speak for itself, and I'll just end it there. Before we get into this podcast, there is just a quick ad for the book that I've written called Tripping, which is coming up right now. Just skip ahead if you've already bought the book, or if you're not interested, or if you don't feel like me listening to me tell you about the book. If you've been enjoying this podcast for a while, I know that you're going to enjoy this next thing that I'm talking about, which is my book. It's called Tripping. And this book and the podcast are definitely interconnected. And sometimes in this podcast, on the solo episodes, I'll actually just open up this book to a random page, read it out, and talk about what it kind of brings to mind or how it was formulated and thought out. These pages aren't full, so this can be kind of a journal type thing where my paragraph in here is a jumping off point. It's a new thought and it will spark creativity within your own mind and you can add to it in your own way. Now that's what I do on the podcast sometimes. And a little bit about this book. It is available on Amazon as a paperback. I highly recommend it as a paperback, as that trip companion, as that journal. And you can just randomly flip to it, or you can read it through and kind of just gain some insights and some nice jumping off points for yourself. But this book was written over a year of my life, a life in isolation and doing intense yoga every single day for over an hour, breath work, and combining that with different psychedelics, predominantly cannabis, and writing down the thoughts that came to my mind. Then I filtered through those thoughts and those writings and edited them up a little bit so that they were concise and that they would create a new thought in your mind. That's the goal of this book. And I hope that it will be interesting. And so far, a lot of people who have bought it have said that it's been really, really awesome. So, I mean, that's that's good for them. And I think if you enjoy this podcast, like I said, just to wrap it all up, if you enjoy this podcast, you will definitely enjoy this book. It's available in the description below. Recommend getting the paperback. It is available on Kindle as well. Thanks, everyone.
My name is Jeff Kitchen. I've been training writers in essentially the craft of the dramatist since about 1989, something like that. Got started in it because a friend of mine was training another friend in playwriting, and I was interested, so I asked if I could come along. He said sure, and we had to read these two books, so I ended up sitting down and reading them for 3 years, these two rare old books on playwriting by a fellow named William Thompson Price, who was a script doctor on Broadway, turn of the century. And he revised scripts for a lot of the top producers of the day, like David Belasco and so on. And he ended up giving so much advice to other playwrights that he ended up forming the first school of playwriting ever in the history of the world. He had 28 students and 24 of them had hits on Broadway. And I just was determined to learn this material, and it was very hard to learn. And so I just read the books repeatedly. It was Price and one of his students named Krauss. And at first I couldn't grasp it. And the way Price wrote was he would finish a section of instruction and he would say, you probably didn't fully grasp what I just said. And if you really want to learn this stuff, you have to understand these fundamentals. And if you don't understand them, then you should do yourself a favor and just give up. because it's pointless to go on if you don't get this stuff. And I was like, yeah, I really don't get what he was talking about. It was complicated stuff. So I went back and reviewed it. And at the end of, I spent all summer reading his book. At the end of the summer, I didn't know the material, but I felt like it was sort of tattooed in my brain. Like you wrote everything down carefully, but you didn't know what it meant. That type of thing. It was in there, but I couldn't decipher it yet. And then I read his student's book all winter, and then I read Price's book and his student's book. And I read each book, you know, a couple times. And then toward the end of that, Price invented a couple tools that are not known anywhere else. He summed it all up and he said, look, it's all sequence, proposition, plot. You do it to the overall story, to each act, to each sequence, to each scene. And as you do it for each scene, you write that scene. And my brain went click, 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 click. And it all just kind of came together. And it was like one of those genuine light bulb moments where I practically saw a light bulb. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. And just had something that, and he didn't even complete his tool called sequence, proposition, plot. He was still in the throes of figuring it out when he died in 1920. And so I pieced the rest of it together from what his student said, because his student was still trying to figure out some of the things that Price talked about. So I pieced it together, kind of completed it, added a little bit to it, and then, you know, worked with it extensively. I was working as a dramaturg in New York theater. I was hired by the Negro Ensemble Company to teach playwriting there on Broadway, where Denzel Washington came out of, and just started teaching playwriting and screenwriting. And then, well, first it was just playwriting, and then playwriting and screenwriting. And then I was out in Hollywood teaching screenwriting. And for instance, I taught the tool sequence, proposition, plot to development execs at all the major Hollywood studios. And they kept saying, this is far and away the most advanced development tool we've ever seen. It's just something that's unique and unusual. And that is like the final tool for plot construction. And I also do work with dilemma and trapping the protagonist between two equally painful choices, two equally unacceptable alternatives, and working with a couple other tools like the Enneagram and a brainstorming tool called the 36 Dramatic Situations, and another tool that Price created that uses logic to pull all of the story together into one coherent thing, so that I have a unique and powerful set of tools that most people who train with me said they've never seen anything like what I do, and that it works better than anything else they've been trying so far. So that's kind of like, you know, the short tour of me sort of plunging in and finding tools that are not standard fare, but are quite powerful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot there. There's a couple questions that come to my mind. With this book by Price, was it common when it came out? Was that information available, or is this something that you found that, I mean, you did say that it's kind of unique that some of the film execs haven't heard this kind of stuff before. So is this something that's different than what is kind of standard in the script writing industry?
Yeah, it's quite different. This is the book here. It's called The Analysis of Play Construction and Dramatic Principle. it was not widely known. You know, maybe around the 1930s, there were a fair amount of playwrights who knew some of this material. But it's not widespread at all. And, you know, of like, there's other top screenwriting teachers are like Sid Field and Save the Cat and The Hero's Journey. And this is truly nothing like them. And yet it all comes from classic dramatic technique, centuries of, you know, advanced structural technique for making plays work. But Price kind of took a left turn around 1900 in terms of like where a number of other things like Sid Field took a lot of his material from a well, part of it came from a German dramaturg named Freytag. So it was kind of like different schools of thought, all of which were part of the same thing. It's kind of like, you know, the history of brain surgery where everybody's drawing from the same people. But, you know, in this instance, in 1900, Price, you know, is still in the same river, but just took a slightly different turn and invented some slightly different techniques that happened to be quite powerful and yet unique, just by, he just wasn't satisfied with what was available at the time. And he tried to create a few more tools because so many of the playwrights who were coming to him, were smart, had good stories to tell, but their material wasn't working dramatically. And he said, there's got to be some tools that I can help them with to land in the ballpark more often, because they're missing a lot and they're not stupid. So he had recourse. He was trained as a lawyer, and he went back to his training in logic, where you can, if you're preparing a case for presentation in court, you use the logic of argumentation, syllogisms, to cook a complex argument down to A and B, therefore C. And a well-prepared lawyer understands his core argument with that level of simplicity and clarity. It's like, look, it's this and this, therefore this. And he said, you ought to be able to state the complete action of a play with that level of simplicity and clarity. And so he went back to his training in the logic of argumentation. And yet he said part of he adapted it because he said, part of our job as a dramatist is to have the audience hanging on the edge of their seat in an unresolved state, you know, somewhere around the end of the second act, where they really don't know how it's going to turn out and you have a cliffhanger, which is very standard. So he said, you set up the core conflict, you touch it off, and then instead of just saying how it ends, you leave it hanging in the form of a question in an unresolved state. So you set it up, you touch it off, and then you get at the question that's in the mind of the audience as they come up on the edge of their seat, wondering how it's going to turn out. And if that question is weak, then what you've set up and touched off isn't strong dramatically. So it's a way to pull the core conflict of the story, which pulls everything else together into one coherent thing, and test it for dramatic power. You set it up, you touch it off, and you've either got the audience or you don't. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you have them? And if it's not testing very strong, then you revise it. This tool was called the proposition, and it's a way to pull it all together and make sure that it has dramatic power, because if what you're proposing is weak, then you revise your proposition and test it again until you really get it, like, that's powerful dramatically. They're really on the edge of their seats. And that's the core nucleus of your script, because this is the transition from story development, where you have a lot of floating possibilities and tentative choices, like, I'm not sure if I'm going to do it this way or this way. And the central proposition begins to really crystallize all that. And then you start plot construction, where you're actually building it.
So how do you test the proposition? How does that actually take place?
Yeah, it has to do with the question in the mind of the audience at this high point of suspense. For instance, if you look at the movie Training Day, you have Jake, played by
Ethan Hawke,
and Alonzo, played by Denzel Washington. And they have a core conflict throughout the story as it develops, where Alonzo is saying, look, you gotta play dirty to take big shots down. This is not Mr. Nice Guy. This is us. You gotta be a wolf to catch a wolf. And at a couple different points, Alonzo uses a fake warrant to rob a dealer's wife and get $40,000 that he purchases a warrant with from the commissioners. And Jake is like, what the hell was that? And they pull over and have an argument on the side of the highway. And he goes, that was armed robbery and attempted murder. And those guys were trying to kill us. And she was yelling about money. And like, I'm going to be in an orange jumpsuit on the news. Like, this is not what I signed up for. This is wrong. And Alonzo says, well, then go back to the valley and be a patrol fairy, be a regular cop, change, you know, flat tires for people. Like, I don't need you. You're done. And he's like, he's short circuiting. His dilemma is between his ambition to join Alonzo's elite undercover squad and his moral compass, which is like, I got to do good and make things right, not be another crook out on the streets. And so they have this argument and Jake gives in. And then later in the story, they're arguing over Alonzo wants Jake to say that he shot Roger, the drug dealer that they kill in the house when Alonzo takes more money. I'm trying not to give away too much of this for people that haven't seen it. But and when Alonzo tries to have him killed, Jake snaps and goes and tries to arrest Alonzo. And that's the beginning of the fight to the finish that the whole story's been building toward. And when Alonzo walks into that room and says, you're under arrest, put the money in the pillowcase, put your guns on the floor, that's the beginning of the fight to the finish that the whole thing is built towards. And the audience comes up on the edge of their seats and they have a specific question in their mind that's the result of the drama that's been crafted. And the question is something like, can he take down Alonzo, or is Alonzo going to kill him? And so you can evaluate the audience at this high point of suspense and put your finger on the question that's in their mind because of the drama that's been set up and touched off. And you want to be like brutally honest with yourself about this question. You don't want to lie to yourself. This is what it will be because I say it will be. It's more like what the question really is based on what you set up and touched off. And the question may well be weak. It might be much weaker than you thought it was going to be. But if you're kind of brutally honest with yourself, then you're like, oh, that's pretty bad. Like, that's not what I need out of this plot. So you go back and revise how you set it up, how you touch it off, how much we're rooting for the protagonist, how much we dislike the antagonist, all the factors that make the audience that much more engaged, and you revise the proposition. And then you evaluate the question again. And like, oh, that's much better, but it could still be stronger. And once you get the audience like white knuckled on the edge of their seat at the high point of suspense, then you're like, okay, that is the thing that I want to build. And so it not only pulls all your material together into one coherent whole, because a movie is like a 2-hour window to do one thing well. So it really has to be coherent and tight. And even a television series like The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or something is still very focused, very tight. It's really doing one thing. There's one complete action throughout it. And so this tool of logic helps you pull all that together and evaluate it for dramatic power before you build it. Because the essence of this process is that you can take most of the energy that goes into rewrites and put it into engineering the script properly before you actually write it.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. I did want to go back to something you said when you were kind of telling your story. You mentioned that you read this book by Price multiple times and that it took a while for you to have that light bulb moment. Why were you so determined to learn what the book had? Why? What was so interesting to you about it? Why did you care so much, I guess, to continue to learn from him?
It was in part because of good English teachers in prep school. I went to Kent Prep School, and if I didn't like my teachers, I didn't respond. I didn't work very hard. But if I did like my teachers and found the material challenging, then I would dig into it. And I got lucky and had good English teachers. And one of them was a Scottish professor who read us, I think it was Macbeth, and he spent all semester reading Macbeth to us. And he would read a few lines of it and then talk about dueling back in Shakespeare's time. And he would end, you know, he'd go off on, he would just talk. And like 45 minutes later, toward the end of the class, he would say some, you know, he would have gotten around to like the idea that in the Old West, the idea that you could draw a gun from your hip and shoot the gun out of somebody else's hand was ridiculous because you could clamp one of those guns in a vise and never hit the same spot twice. So it was like these fascinating tangents where he was elaborating on what was happening in the story and giving us context and helping us understand it and making it all more interesting and dynamic and compelling. And, you know, I would write good papers. We had one teacher where we had to write something every week, and he was really rigorous and taught us how to write good essays. And I just got a hunger for it and was fascinated with playwriting. So when my friend Irving Fisk said he was going to be teaching a buddy of mine playwriting, I said, oh, could I join that class? It was just the two of them. And so it was that hunger that I didn't really, I wasn't all that conscious of it, but I had enough of it in me that when I found out Irving was a playwright, I kind of perked up. And then when I found out that he was going to be teaching playwriting, I was like, wow, it was like a bear trap in me went off, and I just went, oh, can I do that? And then when I sat down with these books, I got the book first because I had found it under Irving's bed that summer. He was like, well, you guys got to read these books. And he's like, well, you found it, so why don't you start with it? And I just went deep into it.
That's pretty cool. That's really interesting, actually, about it's almost like your teacher was analyzing sentence by sentence and breaking it down, and then you took that skill or that ability to do that and did that on this specific subject that now you've made a whole career on.
But what I teach is script building, story creation, story development, plot construction. It's not analytic. I do a fair amount of analytics, but the main thing I teach is how to build a good script.
So from the base up, is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, like, you know, you're standing in line at the checkout counter and somebody in front of you is talking and you hear what they say and you're like, that would make a great movie, and you rush home and you're like, okay, I got a movie. You know, it's a raw idea. And what do you do with it? And how do you turn that into, you know, $1 million script? Because script writing is generally considered the single most elusive of all the literary disciplines. Like, writers most everywhere acknowledge that dramatic writing is the single hardest form of writing. It's tricky, it's slippery. It's because it's not just good storytelling. You got to have storytelling skills as big as you can get them, but it's a drama. It has to be stage worthy. It has to be actable. You have to translate it into a performance medium, where actors can perform it and it holds the audience consistently gripped. And that's true for any genre, whether it's Dumb and Dumber or Hannibal Lecter or anything, it still has to work dramatically. And actors have to be able to perform it. And it has to always hold the audience on the edge of their seat. Billy Wilder said, grab them by the throat and never let go and keep squeezing harder and harder, because they're so fickle, they're so easily distracted that if you lose them for 10 minutes in a movie, the movie doesn't work. It's like a boat with a 2-foot hole in it. Well, here's your boat and it almost works. It's useless. It's absolutely useless. A plane that almost makes it to Cincinnati is no good at all. And 99% of all scripts are rejected. It's way harder than people think. It's a very specific, elusive art form.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask, and maybe this is, there's an obvious answer to this, but you know, the book by Price was obviously about plays, writing plays. You've since worked in Hollywood for, you know, screenwriting. How different are the two? You know, it's a different medium for sure. I mean, there's acting involved, of course, and all that, but how different are the stories? What are sort of the differences between a play and a movie when it comes to writing them?
Yeah, they're very similar in many ways. There's distinct differences. Playwriting is more dialogue heavy, but if you look at people like Quentin Tarantino and Aaron, what's his name? He wrote West Wing and all that stuff. Aaron Sorkin. They're both like, Sorkin comes out of a playwriting background and he writes like a playwright, dialogue heavy. That's, in other words, that's one of the biggest distinctions, and it's often blurred by some of the best writers. But it's basically, they're like first cousins. It's very much the same. It's the craft of the dramatist. It's, you have to start with a good story and dramatize it. You have to make it into a mode that can be performed and that is consistently compelling. So it's I teach the exact same technique to Broadway playwrights, Hollywood screenwriters, Hollywood executives, TV writers, novelists study with me, because it's a useful set of tools. It's like, you know, you hear about like NFL football players who study yoga or ballet because it's good for your body. It's like the craft of the dramatist is good for a novelist.
Right. That makes sense. Okay. So there's a lot of things that cross over by the sounds of it.
Yeah. It's much the same creature. From my point of view, there's no distinction. Some people would say, yeah, there's a huge difference between movies and plays, but not structurally. Like as a doctor looking at the bone structure, it's like, yeah, it's the same creature.
So another thing you mentioned that I wanted to touch on was Enneagram. Is that something that you've taken and added to the teachings that you do? And can you just tell me a little bit about the Enneagram? I know the gist of what it is, but I'm assuming you use that to develop characters.
Let me back it up one second, because a friend of mine in New York was a psychotherapist, Armand DeMille, and he loved movies, and I would go to him with clients for like character profiles, personality, like the kind of thing that the FBI does, like personality profiling for characters in scripts we were developing. At one point, I sent John Leguizamo to him, because John was researching a movie where he was going to play a killer, and Armand showed him police videos of some guy who had murdered his parents 45 minutes earlier. And John said it made the hair on the back of his head stand up. He was like, it really freaked me out. And I said, was it good research? He said, oh, it was incredible. So Armand, I worked with Armand a lot. And at one point he said to me, have you ever heard about the Enneagram? It's the best thing out there. And he'd been doing these incredible character development with us, really insightful this is how this person thinks, this is what they'll tend to do in this type of situation, here's part of their deep flaws, here's what their deepest hunger is. And when he said the Enneagram is the best thing out there, I went right to it. And he turned me on to this group that he worked with called the Enneagram Institute. And so the Enneagram is it's a personality profiling system that says that there's nine basic personality types. And each of them is distinct. So you have like a type 3 is high achieving, driven by image, gets a lot done, very goal oriented. Can in the more unhealthy aspects of a type 3, they're overly concerned with how they appear. And when you get into downright unhealthy aspects of them, they'll commit murder to not have their weaknesses exposed. They're desperate to look good no matter what. Where a type 4 is more emotionally wired, and whereas a type 8 is wired to fight, a type 4 is wired to retreat internally and sort out their emotions before they face everything else. So each type has a different set of tendencies, habits, flaws, strengths, and ways of looking at the world and interacting with it. And each of the 9 types has healthy aspects, average aspects, and unhealthy aspects. They talk about how if your life is coming together, if you're integrating, then you'll tend to exhibit the average to healthy attributes. And if your life is falling apart, disintegrating, then you'll tend to exhibit the average to unhealthy attributes. And so for character development, it's an extraordinary tool because it gives you a time-tested, deep, complex set of insights into the mechanics of what makes your main characters work. It's basically a mixture of ancient wisdom about human nature and cutting-edge psychology. So it's a real science, and it brings a lot together, and it's very similar to the type of stuff that like an FBI profiler would do. And it's extremely useful. And the way we use it is that I have a one sheet from the Enneagram Institute, like literally one page for each of the 9 types that we start with. And you kind of like see, is this my character? Is this him? And there's 2 ways to do it. You're either finding what type your character is organically, or you're saying, okay, I see that my lead character to me at this point feels like a type 3, but the story would be much better if my character was a type 7. And so you can say, okay, so yeah, I'm gonna make this character a type 7 who can't face their own pain and has to always be distracted and is always excitable and enthusiastic and on to the next thing. And that'll make the story much better. So you can either fit the personality type to what feels organic to your character, or you can fit it to what feels best for the story. Either one works fine. But we start with the one sheet. And once you may look through a number of one sheets before you find the one you want. And then the Enneagram Institute has a book called The Wisdom of the Enneagram, and there's a 40-page chapter on each type. So then you can go into that chapter and really go deep into the mechanics of what drives that person, what their motivations are, what their basic fear is, how they'll act in good situations, how they'll tend to fall apart, what their tendencies and habits. And this is just broad observations about this type of person. And it's remarkably insightful. And the more that I studied it, the more respect I had for it. At first, I was just like an inventor in a junkyard. Like, I'll take from this one and I'll take from this one. And I would just mix and match. Like, this is good traits. I'll take from a 3 and an 8 and a 5. But the more that I studied it, the more I was like, wow, just the description of a type 6 has everything that I need times a thousand. Like, I couldn't have, like, I know a lot about people, but I don't know a lot about every type of person. And I don't have deep insight into every type. You know, what I knew is a fair amount, but it's a small contained thing. And you end up going to that well over and over again. All your characters sound alike. So this is a way to differentiate, to go much deeper, to get incredible insights. And really, a big part of it is that if you're like reading the 40-page chapter on a type, and they're saying, in this type of stressful situation, a type 9 will tend to do this and this, and you're like seeing scenes for the movie or the TV script or whatever, and you're like, so it's generating a lot of ideas for the developing plot. So it feeds the story as well with with a lot of possibilities.
One other thing I could see it doing is adding consistency to a character.
Hugely, yes. That's really a huge factor, because it's so easy for characters to be inconsistent and scattered and poorly drawn on the page. And this gives you one complete functioning set of elements with which to build your character. Plus, after you've studied it for a while, you'll realize you know somebody who's like that. Oh, my uncle is just like this. I know this type of person really well. And then that like reinforces what you're getting from the book. And you're like, you get to really know this character and their voice and their traits and their flaws. And so it's really an extraordinary tool for story building and, you know, transforming an audience and getting inside the skin of these characters, where they feel familiar and they act consistently and it makes sense. And even if their own behavior is contradictory, that's still consistent within that type. And it rings true.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than I mean, this happens in TV shows a lot because they're often, you know, drawn out. But there's a new set of writers come on for a season or something, and the character just shifts in a way that is just not believable to who that character was. I've seen that happen lots. So it also makes sense that, you know, to write a character, to write a person, that you would want to study some type of psychology. You would want to understand people to some degree. And then Enneagram having this kind of structure, this system of terms, you know, like the numbers, and each number corresponds to, you know, the peacemaker, the investigator, whatever it is, right? And so then you have just some simple, really basic things to latch onto with your mind, and then you could expand from there. It's a good system for like a building block system, almost, it seems.
Yeah. And it ties the material together, and one of the things the Enneagram does is that part of its function is to help people transform themselves. So it will walk you through, like, you know, how a healthy type 7 will interact with stressful situations, which is they're good at it. An unhealthy type 7 is desperate to avoid their own pain and will drink too much and always be on to the next distraction because they can't stop and deal with their own pain. But they put a lot of work into how an unhealthy or average type 7 can transform themselves and amplify their good points and transcend the things that drag them down. So a lot of it is about how you can become a healthy version of yourself. And for, like, you know, a story with a happy ending, a lot of it is about the transformation of the protagonist, where they have to change in order to complete. And conversely, if it's a tragedy, then their flaws drag them down and destroy them. And it's great for that too, because it gives you so much material so much specific material to build with that it's truly an extraordinary resource.
Yeah, it almost writes the trajectory for you. Like it has it all there.
Yes, and it plus it gives you elements that are unexpected and like obvious once you know them, but you might not have thought of it. And it's so specific that it makes it more real, and the specificity suggests a lot of possible ideas for your particular plot. Like under stress, this type will fall apart in this way, and you can see that in your mind's eye in the story that you're developing.
So you've written a book. I would love to hear a little bit about it. It's called Writing a Great Movie, Key Tools for Successful Screenwriting. Can you tell me about the book and what kind of inspired you to write that?
I wrote that after teaching nonstop for 18 years. It basically consolidated everything that I had. I always taught small groups, maximum six people. Each person had to bring a story that they were working on, and we workshopped them as I explained the tools. So I got people using the tools on their own script right there in the class. And I never taught large groups because the tools are quite complicated and not easy to give people genuine know-how in a lecture format. It's like you can't learn how to ride a bike by watching a guy lecture 1,000 people. And so I was invited to these groups, but I was like, it would sound great when they're listening to it and they would go home and they probably wouldn't be able to use it. So I was always leery, but then finally this one group, got me to come to this one thing, and you know, I was teaching, you know, groups of like 150 people, and there was like a riot outside one of the classrooms with people trying to get in. And I was like, wow, this is quite interesting. It's like time to write my book. So for the same event the next year, I had written and self-published a book. And then that self-published edition got me a lit agent and a publisher. And then we sat down and redid the whole thing for 2 years. And so the book is, you know, training in my tools and giving examples as I explain each tool. And then in the second half of the book, I tried to emulate my small hands-on classroom workshops. So in the second half of the book, I built an original script from a one-line idea and used all the tools in the second half of the book building it. And I said, this will be as different as working in an emergency room is from going to medical school, or it'll be like wrestling a bear in the wilderness compared to studying one in a zoo. Like, we're going to be right in the middle of creating, developing, constructing and writing a script so that it, you know, I tried to make it as hands-on and real and applicable and practical as possible, because it's know-how that you need, not mere knowledge. A lot of education is shoveling knowledge at you and expecting you to cobble it together into something that you can use, and that often doesn't work. You know, that it's a practical manual on story creation and plot construction.
That sounds really interesting. I definitely want to check that out. And then you also have a course you run as well. Still, is that online or in person, or can you just tell me a little bit more about that course you run too?
It's online. It's there's a couple different variants. The main one is a 2-year training program. That you can take for as long as you want, so that, you know, it's designed to be a 2-year program, but you can take a chunk of that if that's all you need or all you want, or it doesn't work out for you. But it's an intensive, deep training in all the tools and all the techniques. And it's mostly, again, hands-on know-how, so that we're constantly building a handful of scripts. We're right in the middle of really doing it, not just talking about it. And we meet 2.5 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's on Zoom. And so that's the core training. And then there's a separate, like, self-study video program that's 64 hours of edited video where you work along with me. It's kind of similar to a flight simulator where you're working hand in glove with me on video as I start with a one sentence idea, develop the story, construct the plot, and then we outline the overall story using Price's advanced tool sequence proposition plot, where we structure the overall story, then we structure each act, then we break the act down into sequences and structure each sequence, and then we break the first sequence down into scenes and do sequence proposition plot for the first scene, and then write the scene, and then sequence proposition plot for the next scene and write that one. Except I'm trying to make, this is a pre-recorded instructional video, and I'm trying to make it as hands-on, as interactive as possible, so people have daily assignments, because I was like up until 4 a.m. each night prepping the video for the next day. So we were constantly moving forward, inventing more and more of the story, pulling it together, throwing parts away that didn't work, like really the real process of it. And the people who, you can just watch it without doing a lot of interaction, or you can go all the way into it where there's daily assignments and you're helping me finish solving something. Like if we didn't quite finish figuring out where he hid the gun that day, your assignment is go home and come up with 20 places where he could hide the gun. And you show up the next day and I've figured it out, but you wrestled with it. So I'm trying to make it as like you do the work. So because if you're merely sitting there watching, you're like, oh, I could do that. It's like watching a professional golfer make a perfect putt and you're like, that looks so easy. Or like watching a surfer stand up on a 30-foot wave and it's like piece of cake. And like if you're not a surfer, you couldn't get up on a 30-foot wave to save your life. It's like it's almost impossible, but the experts make it look easy. So I'm trying to get people over the thing where they're sitting there leaning back going, I could do that, I could do that, when they really couldn't. So it's like, get in there and do it. And then once you've done it, you're like, not only is it harder than I thought, but, oh, I see, you have to like be thinking about this while you do this, which is what he said, but I didn't really appreciate that until I tried to do it myself. And then on next day's video, I'm doing it and they're like, ah, yeah, I see it, I get it. So I'm trying to make it as, again, know-how and hands-on functional knowledge, not mere information. And so in the process of making it as interactive as possible, once we've gotten down to doing sequence proposition plot for that, for the opening scene, the person taking the video writes that scene. And then I show up the next day and I wrote my version, but they're actually writing it. And then we do sequence proposition plot for another scene and they write it. So they're literally writing the script. So it says, so there's a draft that I wrote and it's all in 64 hours of video, but it's all dense, high intensity information. It took me, I think, about 9 months to create this whole thing. They've written a draft and used all the tools. And it was originally designed as a precursor to the advanced live training, but I've since put out a subscription program that has a lot of instructional video, like 80 hours of instructional video, so that to join the live daily 2-year course, you just have to take like 8 or 10 of these videos, and then you speak the language well enough to participate in the advanced class, where we're right in the middle of building 3 or 4 scripts and doing drills and training and working on individuals' scripts. So you know, an attempt to give people access at different levels and in different time formats. And then I've always got a couple like evening classes going where, like, for 2 hours every Tuesday for 5 weeks, we'll study dilemma or story building, that kind of thing.
Wow. Sounds like an amazing resource. Yeah. So that's available on script.kitchen. That's your website. And that's also in the show notes in the description of the podcast. So we've been talking a lot about the creative process, screenwriting. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you do personally to just improve yourself. Like, we have to be in a position to be able to do work, right? So how have you worked on yourself, I guess, to be able to do the things that you need to do in the day?
Well, one of the biggest things in my life was that in the same time that I sat down and started reading these books on price, I also took an extracurricular college course on what was called stress management. And the teacher was a yogi. Like, he literally lived in some ashram. He looked like a California surfer and he had white clothes on. And one of the main things he taught us was deep breathing, deep yoga breathing. And we did it in class for 15 minutes. And it's called a belly breath, abdominal breathing, where you fill your abdominal, your belly, and then you fill your middle chest, and then you fill your upper chest. And we would do that for 15 minutes in the class. And he said, like, the average person breathes 2 pints, but your lungs hold 7 pints. And the trick was to sit up straight so your nervous system is open, you know, not kinked. And you breathe out twice as slow as you breathe in so you don't get lightheaded. And we would just do that by the clock for 15 minutes, like count 1,003 on the in-breath, a vigorous in-breath and a slow metered out-breath to like 1,006. And by the end of 15 minutes, like even 7 minutes in, I wouldn't notice any benefits or anything. But after a while, you start to feel good. The colors look a little richer. And by the end of 15 minutes, you feel good and well and like able to deal with things. And we did that every class. And then at one point he said, okay, so your homework for this week is to do at least 10 minutes of this yoga breathing every day. And normally throughout life, I would have been like, yeah, whatever, like shine that on. But because he'd been doing it in the class with us and I could really see the benefits, I just did it every day that week, even if it was in the car on the way to class. And I never stopped ever since then. And that was like 1981. And in like 1985 or something like that, I met a Kung Fu teacher who was teaching us Kung Fu, but he was also teaching us what's known as Qigong, which is part of Kung Fu, which is the kind of stuff you see Bruce Lee doing to warm up for a fight, you know, like, you know, those kind of things. Brings your chi up, energizes you. It's basically working with the upgrading the electrochemistry in your body. And I talked about the breathing I'd been studying and showed him the type of stuff I was doing. And he's like, yeah, that's Qigong. That's powerful stuff. He said, he said, you know, with the Qigong, you have to do it every day, no matter what. And I had actually already read a book on Qigong, but it was very complicated. My cousin was really into it. And he said, you got to read this book. It's the best martial arts book in the world. So I went and read it. And I was like, okay, that's a lot. You know, now I need a teacher. And then this guy showed up. And one of the things they emphasized in the book is do it every day, no matter what. They said it's like watering a rare cactus. Like, you got to do it every day or you go back to the beginning. It dies. Like, keep it going. And so when my Kung Fu teacher saw what I was doing for yoga breathing, he said, you've already been doing Qigong for 4 years. So you're already, so I just kept it going and started doing that. And I've been doing Qigong every day since like 1986, but it really goes back to 1981. And I do it first thing in the morning to wake up. And just your picture just went out. Okay, no biggie. I assumed you were fine. I'll just start again. So I do it every day, first thing in the morning, and it's how I wake up and it's how I get going, and it clears my mind and I feel ready for the day. It's really like I'm a different person once I do it, and I don't feel like ready to tackle the world. Because whereas before I was kind of sleepy and groggy, and then once I do it, I'm alert and energetic and all that. And it Qigong is famous for slowing down the aging process and keeping you healthy. It's like getting your piano tuned every day. It brings you back to optimal health. Qigong is called an internal martial art, where you're working with the organs. Each organ has its own distinct chemistry, you know, like each organ squirts its own chemicals into the system, and each organ has its own magnetic field. So when your Qigong is working with the organs and the energy in your body, the Qi, you're basically upgrading your electrochemistry. So you keep bringing your body back to optimal health, like getting tuned, so that you tend to not get sick as easily and you tend to slow down the aging process. So it's great for writing because it's great for clarity of mind. You know, it's like you can, because your brain uses 25% of the oxygen that comes into your body. So if you do 15 minutes of deep breathing and you're taking in 7 pints of air, your brain is getting super oxygenated, which changes your moods, your hormones, your enzymes, your ability to deal with the world, your emotional stability, everything, and, you know, just creativity. And, you know, writers are prone to like too much coffee. So like, instead of another cup of coffee, you know, do 10, 15 minutes of deep yoga breathing. And in my subscription program, where I have these 80 hours plus of video, one of them is 10 minutes of yoga breathing, or you can watch it for 5 more minutes and do 15 minutes. And it really is a great thing for writers to know, to have in their arsenal. And there's even a fascinating component to that, which is that once you've done 10 or 15 minutes of deep breathing, every cell in your body is oxygenated. And there's another breathing exercise called non-breathing, which is famous for speeding up the evolution of thought. So you sit still and you pick a spot on the floor that's in front of you so that you can just focus your physicality, like your eyes aren't moving around, your brain is still, and you're neither breathing nor are you holding your breath. So it's not closed, but you're not drawing anything in. And you get this tremendous stillness and the ability to focus and clarify. And it's great for like thinking through a story problem. And it's famous for speeding up the evolution of thought. Gandhi was really into it. It's extreme, and it's considered a breathing exercise, not a meditation. And even though to me it seems like a meditation, but it was interesting because if I'm like looking at this spot on the floor and I've just done 10 or 15 minutes of yoga breathing and I'm just sitting there looking at this spot on the floor, start to get like concentric circles going in and out around this spot on the floor. And I find myself just kind of thinking through what I have to do for my day. And then I often have this thing where I hear like an audible click. And it's like, I'm just like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm focused. I'm clear. I know what I'm going to do first. And when I hear this audible click, it's like, I'm ready to go for the day. It's like, I know exactly what I'm going to do first. The next batch of things I have to do, I can see them in order. And I know what I have to do now. And I'm focused and calm and clear. And I'm like, I'm just ready to go. And so it's remarkable. And there was this one other cool thing about the non-breathing exercise. I see a few references to it here and there. but there was some book on yoga, and you know, it was all written in English, but there was a page of Tibetan writing, and 2/3 of the way down the page is a single sentence in English. And I'm like, what the hell is this? And I look down there and it says, when doing the non-breathing exercise, we dare you to do it with your lungs empty. And I was like, wow, like who knows about non-breathing? Like, you know, you'd never hear about it. And I was like, okay, so we dare you to try it with your lungs empty. I was like, okay. So the next time I did it, instead of just sitting there where it's like your lungs are neutral, you're not breathing and you're not holding your breath, I expelled all the air from my lungs and then sat there. And it was no different because I still wasn't taking any air in, but my lungs were empty. And then I'm still looking at that spot on the ground and it turned day glow green pretty much right away and was still getting the concentric things. And I was like, damn, that's trippy. It was just like, and like such a weird thing to see this one sentence in English, but it was a legitimate thing. You know, it's about the, you know, the chemistry, brain chemistry, basically, and focus and intention and clarity.
Yeah, that's interesting. it's amazing what we can do. You know, it affects, like, our brain is able to make chemicals, right? And oxygen and everything else we breathe is all going to change the way that we operate. So there's a lot to breathing. There's a lot going on there for sure. It's very interesting.
And people underestimate it. They're like, breathing. Okay, I do that all day. Like I get that for free. Like I'm going to waste 10 minutes doing that. But you think about how many times you waste 10 minutes during the day, like just looking at your phone or like dozens of times in a realistic, you know, unless you're just working nonstop every second. So the idea that you take 10 minutes and do conscious, focused, properly executed 3-part yoga breath really upgrades your brain chemistry. And it's great for stress. Like you can have like a parent die or something and it's not going to make you feel wonderful, but it really helps you deal with the world. It's like, instead of being like, oh God, I can't even move. You're like, okay, I can go through my day. It kind of brings you back toward normal. And if you're feeling good, it makes you feel really good. And if you do it a second time during the day, you feel great. It's like, it's the kind of thing where instead of the 6th cup of coffee, you do 10 minutes of breathing. It's really going to change things.
Yeah, I want to try that. That sounds really good. I've had success with breath work before in combination with movement yoga and found amazing results.
That's what Qigong is in a lot of ways. It's breath work with specific movements and intention, because your qi goes where your concentration goes. So you can like concentrate on your hand and it'll warm up and you can do healing. Qigong is a real healing art where, you know, you might see like in a kung fu movie where somebody gets hurt and they like do this and make a sore muscle, like they're healers as well as fighters. You know, it's all Shaolin monk stuff, but it's quite useful. And we've, like, in terms of writing, our kung fu teacher, we would do these out of body meditations, which are called a Shen meditation, where your qi can go 10 inches from your body, but your Shen can go anywhere you want. And even through time and space, which is interesting, so that we would go up out of our bodies and we would go up into outer space and sit on the moon and sit in he would say, okay, sit in the middle of the sun and breathe in the sun, or go sit in the middle of the ocean and breathe in the ocean, or go sit in the middle of this rock. And like, we were doing that. And after class, we would compare notes. And like one of the kids in the class said, so he would ask like, what did you see when you were in this meditation? And one kid goes, okay, so I'm up on this top, up on this mountaintop, and there's a temple nearby and there's rainbow candles next to me that go like miles high up into the sky. And I look down at my body and it's all made of rainbow light. And the teacher's going, this is like a 12-year-old kid. He goes, who are these kids? Like, they were like, and they would say like, I saw you on the moon. Like, and we would, and it's so interesting. Like one day I was doing a Shen meditation every day on the right next to the Pacific Ocean, and I would send my Shen out of my body, and I would go down to the ocean, and one day my Shen is like skimming across the top of the ocean like, you know, a seagull or something. The next day it's underwater frolicking like a dolphin, gone inside rocks. I've been done the meditation under a tree and go inside the tree, and I can feel the wet coolness of the sap. I can go inside animals for like see healing things. I can't go inside of people. Animals are much easier. And in that same week that I was doing those meditations, there was a fire, you know, 30 miles away or something. And I sent my Shen out to the area of the fire, and it was rolling around in the flames. It's like this really unusual capability that our bodies have. And our teacher always talked about how your Shen can go anywhere through space or time. So like my wife's mother died before we had babies. And so I said, well, you know, maybe that works. So I did a Shen meditation and I went back to her before she died when she was dreaming. And I showed her the babies. And like, I don't know if it was real or anything, but I tried it. And like, you know, maybe she dreamed about our babies years ago. I really don't know. But the experiences I've had with it are genuinely extraordinary, and it's a real healing art, and it's real, and it's potent, and it's great for like creative writing and being in touch with what's around you and being in touch with yourself and being able to see into things, to solve problems and feel your way into things. And, you know, instinct and intuition, you know, it's a way of just getting deeper into those things.
Incredibly fascinating.
And it really fits with writing. I mean, it just goes hand in glove with the creative life and that kind of thing.
Just got one final question for you. This is just general advice kind of stuff. What would you suggest somebody do if they have a script idea? Like, how should they start? What would be some of the first steps?
The main thing that I teach is that one good, strong dilemma carries the film. And that was the main thing that Irving Fisk first taught me, was one good, strong dilemma that builds to a crisis, that forces a decision in action about the dilemma around the three-quarter point in the story at the crisis point, and then the resolution of the dilemma. And so, and that's one of the things that's unique and different about the way that I teach, is a lot of screenwriting teachers talk about inciting incident. I don't pay any attention to that. I'm focused on dilemma, which incorporates starting the story with a powerful event and what the protagonist thinks he wants versus what he really needs, and all these other things get incorporated into a good, strong dilemma. And like we talked briefly about Jake's dilemma in Training Day, where it's unacceptable to let go of his deep ambition to make it onto Alonzo's squad. He tells Alonzo, I'll do anything you want to make it in there. Nothing's going to pry him away. And the director, Antoine Fuqua, talks about how that's Jake's fatal flaw, is his ambition. Nothing's going to make him let go of that, but nothing's going to make him let go of his moral compass. He's like, I'll do anything, but I won't do that, but I can't let go of my ambition, but I can't let go of my moral compass. That's what the movie's about. His dilemma is what the movie's about. And blanking on the director's name, Cameron Crowe wrote Almost Famous, about the kid journalist, rock journalist, traveling with the band Stillwater. He said Almost Famous is about William's dilemma, that it's unacceptable to become friends with the band because then he ceases to be an objective journalist. And yet it's equally unacceptable to not be friends with them because they're the coolest people he's ever met, and he's uncool. He's like desperate to be in the in crowd, but his mentor is saying, do not become friends with them. Don't let them suck you in, because they'll write the article for you and it'll be a puff piece. It'll glorify their stuff. You know, you want to be honest and merciless. that's real journalism. And he really wants to be that, but he really wants to be in the in crowd. He's desperate to be one of them, and he's desperate to stay removed. So it's, and he said, and Cameron Crowe says, that's what the movie's about, his dilemma. And that's what I teach. And when I heard Cameron Crowe say that, I was like, yeah, that's what I teach. That's so cool. It's interesting because successful professional screenwriters are often one of the few people that talk knowledgeably about dilemma. Most screenwriting teachers don't talk about it at all. And those who mention it in passing don't understand that it's a dilemma that constitutes the full proportion of the script. Training Day is about that dilemma. In Tootsie, once, see, there's some setup time where you have to get to know the character and care about them, and the story develops. But early in the story, the protagonist should get caught in this good, strong dilemma, and that dilemma should carry the whole rest of the film up to the ending, which is the resolution of the dilemma. And you see that in Tootsie when we meet Michael Dorsey at the beginning, and he's obviously an extremely talented actor, but he's also a difficult actor, and he has tremendous difficulty with women. He doesn't, you know, he's just kind of a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, doesn't call them. And so he's really flawed in a lot of ways. But once he dresses up as Dorothy and gets this role on this soap opera, nothing's going to make him let go of this. He's finally got work. He's got a fat paycheck. He's got respect as an actor. He's got clout on the set. He's falling in love with the Jessica Lange character. Like, it's his first real relationship as far as we can tell. Nothing's going to make him let go of that. But he's also got the horny actor, John Van Horn, French kissing him at the end of their first scene. His friendship with Sandy, the Terry Garr character, is coming apart. His personal life is quite difficult. And he's, you know, he's caught up in this double identity where he's running from room to room, taking off the wig, putting on a dress. It's like creating him and destroying him at the same time. So he can't let go, and he can't keep doing it. And that dilemma is what that movie's about. So that's part of the essence of what I teach. And once you have a dilemma for your protagonist, then you want to go to the Enneagram, because each different personality type will interact with the particular dilemma in a different way. Like, where a type 8 is wired to fight, and a type 4 is wired to retreat and sort out their emotions first, and a type 3 is overly concerned with how they look to others, each type will react in a different way to the dilemma, and it will substantially shape your story. So that because how they react and interact with that dilemma affects the whole rest of the story, because of their tendencies, basic fears, that kind of stuff. And we're also working with a tool called the 36 Dramatic Situations, which is a brainstorming tool, which is things like ambition, madness, disaster, the necessity of sacrificing loved ones. These are elements that this list of 36 is everything, what's the best way to say it? It's 36 elements that every story consists of. In the same way that with the periodic table of elements, the 118 elements, everything we know consists of those 118 elements. The chair you're sitting on, you can describe quite completely from one point of view as magnesium, carbon, iron. Like, it describes that chair quite completely from one point of view, but it is quite complete from that point of view. So every story has elements like madness, disaster, obtaining, obstacles to love. And so bringing these elements in as you're creating a story and creating a dilemma and working with the Enneagram. So we're basically working with these three tools kind of simultaneously. main focus on the dilemma, with the Enneagram, you know, decisively affecting that, and the 36 dramatic situations suggesting possibilities, giving you deeper insight. And of course, you've got to have a good story idea, because a weak story, all these tools applied to a weak story, is like trying to make a gourmet meal out of spoiled food. And so many people put so much effort into stories that are never going to go anywhere. You got to have an eye for story. It's like if you ever like went to an auction with an experienced horse person and they look the horses over and be like, do not buy that one. Spend the whole damn farm to get this one. Like they, and you look at the horse and you're like, I can't tell the difference. And the person is, if you buy this one, you're fired. Like, don't even go near this horse and sell your house to get this one. They can see something. You got it. You need that as a professional storyteller. You got to know the difference. And it's really important. And so what a writer can do if they're starting a story actually comes back to my new book, which is The Hero's Dilemma, which walks you through building a story from scratch by focusing on dilemma. And all this does is dilemma, Enneagram, and the 36 dramatic situations. But we construct the complete framework for an original story that I start from scratch. So it's an excellent guide to how to get started.
Awesome. Wow. Awesome. Is that coming out or is that already out, that book?
It's out. Yeah, it's out on Amazon right now, called The Hero's Dilemma. Drama at the heart of your story.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Awesome. Well, it was great chatting with you, Jeff. Thank you so much for sharing all this amazing information. I think that there'll be some people in my audience that will be receptive to it. So I appreciate your time today, Jeff.
Great. Thank you. It was really fun.